The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. Well, with a joint U.S.-Soviet space adventure, a great gesture of goodwill, nevertheless a tremendously expensive grandstand play for attention, for deterrent, the United States and the Soviet Union seem to once again be joining hands as they did over vodka and cocktails and champagne in the streets of shattered Berlin at the close of World War II. But while Russians and Americans were orbiting together in camaraderie and companionship above, their counterparts down here below were still playing the deadly game of nuclear stalemate. The respective spying systems were no doubt busy. The United States was conducting picture-taking flights of Soviet missile sites from our many, many satellites in the sky, over 1,400 of them up there, by the way, most of them labeled made in the Soviet Union or the United States. So both governments, while our astronauts and cosmonauts were orbiting overhead in friendship and camaraderie, were nevertheless busily spying on one another. The various governments of the world were going about the business as usual in the enormous and deadly game of the struggle for communist supremacy against the determination of the United States and its allies and friends to remain alive and well in a world of freedom. It's strange, isn't it, that while millions of Americans and Soviet citizens were listening to the voices of our astronauts from space, that very likely Russians elsewhere were listening to the voice of President Ford in private telephone conversations with heads of government abroad. You heard that, didn't you? That there was no question now about the capability of the Soviet intelligence service to monitor official Washington calls, including some of the calls of the President of the United States. You know, snooping is big business these days. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. It involves satellites overhead, perhaps by the dozens or the hundreds. It involves who knows how many employees of various governments, paramilitary and military organizations, like a secret government within a government, as some have accused the CIA of being, and perhaps not without some small measure of justification. Isn't it incredible? This deadly Cold War game, no matter what we talk about concerning detente or wheat deals, but isn't it incredible how everybody seems to be spying on everybody else these days, including the federal government and various of its bureaus and agencies spying on individuals? As a matter of fact, you know, I heard they even tapped my telephone. It was in an Associated Press article some time back, and I thought, well, at least they put me in some fairly good company there. They had the American Civil Liberties Union, the Jewish Anti-Defamation League. Would you believe they even had people like Doris Day and John Wayne and leading Hollywood people, as well as many, many government officials, senators, congressmen, governors of states. And also they listed in there somewhere my name. And I thought, man, those guys are hungry for little bits and pieces of news here and there. And so every now and then, if I'm talking on the telephone, I'll insert a little comment for whoever's listening, the IRS or Customs or the FBI or the CIA, and be sure to have a raspberry or something for the people who are recording the conversation. But isn't it incredible, all this spying that is going on? On the one hand, we make these gestures in space of undying friendship, of detente, of camaraderie, the Russians and the Americans getting together again, and on the other hand, down below, is this mad scramble for spying on each other at every level, and even spying on ourselves. You know, I heard a story not long ago that really did stand my hair just about on end, that made me realize how close, at least in some respects, certain agencies of the government are edging the American people toward a virtual police state climate. It was published in a flying magazine, and it was called The Big Ovaltine Bust. And it was a story of a young fellow who had gone up on some wildlife photography assignment into Canada and had flown back to land at Great Falls to be cleared by customs. The customs official, along perhaps with a local policeman, but at least some people came out, they began to search the aircraft, to search the man, everything apparently routine, customs clearance. As they're searching through his duffel, and threw his shaving kit. His dog, which accompanied him on this wilderness camping trip, is walking around sniffing at these men. This one rather burly police type, rather brusque and rather officious in his manner, came out of the duffel with a plastic jar, a sealed plastic jar. He looked at it suspiciously, opened the cork and sniffed at it, and said, "What's this?" asking about the brown kernel-like substance inside. And the pilot of the airplane said, "Why, that's Ovaltine. I had it with me on my camping trip." "Ovaltine, is it?" the customs official said. "It doesn't look like Ovaltine to me." So he bottled it back up and promptly seized that and was going to run a test on it. He picked up some canned goods. I think it was vegetable soup, but I forget. Maybe it was tomatoes. He picked up a can of vegetable soup or tomatoes or both, and he said, "What's this?" And he shook it. And the fellow said, "Well, it's just what the label says. It's vegetable soup or it's tomato juice." "Oh, it is it?" And so the customs official opened the can of vegetable soup and opened the can of tomato juice or whatever and poured it out on the ramp by the airplane. Now, the fellow was beginning, understandably, to become a little annoyed at this point, especially as his dog moved up to help himself to the spilled vegetable soup. And so the fellow grabbed his camera. He was a photographer by profession and probably had one slung around his neck anyway, and backed off to take a picture of his dog lapping up this vegetable soup that the customs agent had spilled out on the ramp. And the customs agent said, "Here, what are you doing? No pictures here," and grabbed his camera, and then forced him to open it, pull out the entire brand new roll of 36 frames of unexposed film, very costly, and destroy it. Well, the fellow was placed under arrest, and he was taken in a police car downtown. He was taken into a room to be interrogated. The customs official came walking out, triumphantly holding up a vial of liquid. And he said, "What color's that?" And the young pilot said, "Well, that's brown." The customs official said, "Oh, no, it's not. That's purple. And that's LSD you got in that plastic jar. You said it was Ovaltine. That's LSD." And he said, "You got enough there to blow up the whole city." "Book it," he said. They took him in, they photographed him, they fingerprinted him, and they booked him on a charge of smuggling narcotics into the United States. I believe he was either then released, I don't think there was any bail set, but his airplane was confiscated, and then subsequently it was determined by laboratory analysis, rather than this quick little test kit that this local fellow had apparently, that it was in fact Ovaltine, all right. It was not LSD. And subsequently, some days later, the young fellow received a letter from the Customs Bureau, and it told him that his airplane was going to be released to his custody now. It had been seized, it had been hangared, and he could go pick it up at thus and such an address at the airport where it was in the hangar, and then he had to go and pay something like $14 a day, or whatever it was, for nearly 2 weeks of the length of time the thing was hangared. And by the way, there wasn't even a, "By the way, we're sorry," or "We caused you the inconvenience," or "Oops, we goofed," or anything of the kind. Just a nice officious letter, "Your airplane is now available for you to go pick up." And that was the end of the story. And really, that was just about enough to curl your hair. That you can actually be grabbed and booked and taken downtown and have your property seized and so on. Now, I have reason to believe that there are those in government who have less than the greatest character that the world has ever seen, meaning that I think all of us have seen in recent times that there are people, even high in government, who have been known to tell other than just the purest truth. There are people in government who sometimes apparently have personal vendettas and personal aims that they would like to pursue, personal goals they would like to fulfill, which have to do perhaps with vanity and ego, as well as just the most faithful and loyal exercise of the oath of their office. Not that I'm casting aspersions on any of our loyal government employees or elected officials. Far be it from me to say that an elected official is anything other than he says he is. But It has come to public light here recently that many of the top government agencies, especially those involved in monitoring the activities of private citizens such as the IRS, the FBI, and the CIA, have been involved in wiretapping, in formulating documents and files on literally thousands upon thousands of American citizens, including many of the top elected officials of the United States, including, apparently, and they're now going around and around on that, even as one man alleges and other people are denying, and that's all you can say about it, but even planting people inside the White House. At least that's what some people claim they have been doing. So don't feel that it's real strange if your telephone has been tapped. Next time you talk on the phone to somebody about something, anything from a hunting to a fishing trip, be sure to say, by the way, any of you guys tapping my telephone, this is for you, and then come up with a nice little cliche of some kind. I think it'll brighten up their day and make it far more enjoyable. It's enormously amazing in this world in which we live that is so complex, so sophisticated, so technologically oriented, that at the very same time we are willing to spend millions upon millions of dollars, literally wasted because of a grandstand play in space to get Americans and Russians smiling together, that actually behind the backs of each of the countries, the spying is going on apace. A deadly game of constant struggle and vying for position by the use of satellites in space as well as satellites in states. That means satellite nations who are recipient of technology, of technicians who go along with it, and along with them, usually, the collection and assortment of spies. So that wherever Soviet arms and Soviet nuclear reactors go, Soviet technicians and spies go along too. The United States and the Soviet Union are the biggest weapons suppliers on the face of the earth, and the most critical place where all of this is going on, as a matter of fact, is the Middle East. So don't be deceived because the Russians smile and shake hands and you see pictures about Soviets who are very excited about the launching of Soyuz and the cosmonauts in space, because the Soviet leadership has never disavowed its goal to bury us, never given up on the basic communist goal of world dominion. That's what they want to do. They want to bury the United States and its allies. Now today, the most insistent, hollow-sounding board to echo communistic propaganda has become the General Assembly and even the Security Council of the United Nations. You gotta hand it to Moynihan. And even to Mr. Kissinger, who have given the UN what for recently, and I'm with them. I said a long time ago that when that Afro-Asian bloc voted that it was now perfectly all right for small nations here and there around the country, around the world, to seize and to expropriate, a polite word for steal, American and other foreign investments in those countries, which in some cases is the major source by which that country even began to develop, whether you're talking of fruit or whether you're talking of mining or the development of timber or the development of hydroelectric projects or oil development and exploration, whatever you're speaking of, in country after country around the world, if it had not been for American private enterprise of sending avalanches of millions of private money into these countries to develop some of the raw materials and the industries, then the jobs, the homes, the roadways, the public services of clean water and sewage, of electricity, would simply not be there. Now, increasingly, the bloc of the Afro and Asian nations, which are primarily Soviet satellites, at least recipient of Soviet aid, technicians, and military supplies, are voting as if a group of zombies and automatons. Soviets pull the string, and all the little puppet states, whose voice, by the way, is equal to that of the United States in any one of them. I mean, you talk about tiny Iceland, you can talk about the tiniest little country in Africa you never even heard of before. If the country has a total population of 50,000 and has a king living in a huge palace the size of Buckingham but without water and lights, which one of them did build out in the middle of the jungle someplace, and is sitting ensconced in with his about six wrinkles in his navel and 17 or 40 wives, but with no electric lights, but nevertheless a huge castle about the size of the one in which the Queen of England resides. But this tiny nation has exactly the same clout by its one nation, one vote in the United Nations as does the United States of America. But the United States is the host country to the UN. We foot the bills. Now, at least, finally, some American officials are beginning to lead some of the Afro-Asian nations to suspect that the United States may not always be willing to foot the bills. Now, that'd be wonderful if we really meant that. Just like it would be wonderful if America could take a good, strong look at the shipments of wheat and of all sorts of aid and even military hardware going to countries who will not support United States foreign policy in the United Nations, such as India, Egypt, and others. Why it seems to be such an enormously difficult decision to arrive at least the point where you might want to hint to somebody in one of these foreign countries who wants to go about the business of the extermination of Israel, for example, as in Egypt's case. Hey, if you guys want to keep receiving the wheat to feed your starving millions, what about easing off? No, but we don't do that. Now, the Soviet Union, they do, see. They have the idea that when they send arms, money, technicians, nuclear reactors, wheat, what have you, into countries, that those countries owe the Soviet Union some favors in return. The United States doesn't. What the United States looks for in return, just like a chapter in the Bible that talks about harlotry in reverse, is we give millions and billions, and then we sit around happily waiting, kind of in a sadomasochistic vein, perhaps, for that nation to turn around and spit in our eye, kick us in the shins, and slap us in the face. And we want that to happen, apparently, because that's what we know is going to happen. It's what we wait for, and when it does happen, then we know exactly where everybody stands, and we increase our shipments of grain. We increase our aid that we send over to these nations, who rarely even say, thank you. I don't know how the process works, do you? Now, you know, when we did hint, at least one congressman hinted that maybe the United States might be thinking about curtailing wheat shipments to Egypt in the wake of the last go-around in the Middle East. Then when they had their OPEC energy conference over there in Algiers, the Algerian foreign minister stood up and began saying, it is inadmissible for any modern state to think of utilizing some of the basic essentials for human survival as a military or a political tool. And I thought, this guy's got to be completely out of his tree and out from under his shower cap. This is incredible. Here is a member of one of the North African oil producers who joined with the other countries in slapping a total embargo upon nation after nation around the world, sending the entirety of the Western industrialized countries' economies into utter chaos, practically down the drain, a nation such as India building up enormous monthly balance of payments deficits to the point that the entire industry of a starving country based upon the monsoon season, desperately needing the millions upon millions of gallons of oil-based herbicides, fungicides, fertilizers, pesticides, in order to feed its millions of people. But suddenly, with the quadrupling and then even hiking beyond that, the price of oil could not afford it, and was simply going to be facing an absolute impossible situation. Yet here is a starving nation like India, with tens of thousands dying, millions, perhaps being threatened with death, in India and Bangladesh and that area of Southeast Asia, the subcontinent, as they call it, of India. And yet here is this Algerian oil minister making the statement that nations just cannot, it's inadmissible, it just is unthinkable that they should use resources vital to human survival as a political tool, and that's precisely what oil is, and precisely what that oil minister and that precise nation had done only weeks before that conference, had joined in with the other countries in slapping a total embargo on oil. Well, right now, that's what makes the world go around, isn't it? Is oil. And the money that comes pouring into Arab coffers and other oil producers' coffers as a result of the purchase of oil and of energy sources by Europe, big countries in Europe, some of the most powerful economies today, certainly West Germany is, and yet about 99, 98, 95, don't quote me on the exact figure, but it's up over 90%, a whopping majority of all of the energy sources come directly from Middle Eastern and North African oil suppliers. Their life's blood depends upon peace in the Middle East. And yet there is no real guarantee of peace in the Middle East. Now, right now, we see the United Nations getting ready to vote on the business of a peacekeeping force. Egypt has said it will not renew, and I believe it's up on about July 24th, the permission for the UN peacekeeping force to act as a buffer between Israel and Egypt along in the Sinai. You know, you need to go back in recent history and remember what that was like in that last war in the Middle East. Do you remember very well the use of satellites then? I've inferred the use of satellites today, even in spying on the president's telephone calls. Well, it wasn't until Soviet spy satellites had proved that the Israelis had, in fact, forded the canal with an army that Egypt began to scream. You can go back and look in your newspapers. It is there. You can go back and research it in the library. Day after day after day, in the beginning of that war in the Middle East, Egypt was getting the upper hand. They were gobbling up territory in the Sinai. They were hurling the Israelis back. The Israelis had to just about leave a token force in the Sinai and first of all deal with the most immediate threat, which was closer to their border in the Golan. They first had to find some way to knock out the Syrian attack, and they did. It was only after they did that, and this time with hideous losses. They lost an enormous amount of aircraft, of tanks, and of men. Then they took on the Egyptians, and then the tide of battle began to turn. And then they encircled, on African soil, inside of Egypt, the Third Army. And it was only when the Soviet Union proved to unwilling Egyptian leadership, look, the Israelis are going to be knocking on the door of Cairo if you guys don't stop it, that Egypt began to scream for the UN to stop that war. Why didn't Egypt stop it? Egypt started it. But now they wanted the UN to stop it. But it's interesting, isn't it, that for days when they had the upper hand, they didn't want the UN to stop it. But when the Third Army was surrounded, they wanted the UN to stop it. So sure enough, Mr. Kissinger got involved. There were trips back and forth by American and Soviet leadership. The UN began to exert some influence. The United States and the Soviet Union began to exert some influence. And the participants agreed to a ceasefire, and you remember all the negotiations along the highway directly for the first time, by the way, in any modern configuration. You saw leaders of the armies of Israel and of Egypt meeting face-to-face in tents along the roadway between the Suez Canal and Cairo, a road that I have driven to the city of Suez. I remember it so well. And they were meeting daily with regard to those truck convoys coming through the Israeli lines into the city of Suez to bring water and food and supplies, medical supplies and so on, to the beleaguered and completely entrapped and surrounded Third Egyptian Army. Had Israel wanted to do so, Israel could have obliterated the Third Egyptian Army. Now today, on the street, the average person of maybe the working class in Israel is very upset at Mr. Henry Kissinger. They don't like the fact that, apparently the way they put it, Kissinger forced Israel to let the Third Army go. They seem to feel that they have been a little bit betrayed. Yet, on the other hand, official Israeli leadership insists on equal role for the United States in talks between Egypt and Israel. But, you know, the big question today is not the joint Soviet-U.S. space mission. The big question is, will we have peace in the Middle East? And that's where Bible prophecy zeroes in. Is peace in the Middle East? And Bible prophecy indicates that in the next few months and years, it is once again going to erupt. Whether it's going to be once, twice, three times, or five times over the next few years, and finally, actually trigger nuclear war, is anybody's guess. But right now, in the summer of 1975, is a critical period of time for the Middle East. And if present negotiations break down, we could see another war, a full-scale one, in the Middle East by fall. We received a call-in report from my son Mark just before coming on the air live today, and I want you to hear it, of what he is saying from on the spot in Jerusalem concerning the present situation along the Sinai between Egypt and Israel.
Mark Armstrong, Jerusalem. Officials in Cairo have blamed Jerusalem for the long delay in concluding an interim agreement between Israel and Egypt. The agreement, put simply, would facilitate the return of occupied land in Sinai to Egypt in exchange for an Egyptian pledge of no war to Israel. One of the major issues that has been prolonging the negotiating process is Egypt's demand that the Mitmeh and Gedi passes in their entirety be returned to Egyptian hands. Israel feels that these strategic passes are absolutely necessary for her security. Israel does not want to give up something that would place her in too precarious a position defensively in case an overall settlement in the Middle East does not materialize in the future, as is hoped. Another major sticking point has been the issue of timing. Israel is asking for a long-range agreement of non-aggression, while Egypt is insisting that it be short-term, with the vague promise of annual renewal. Prime Minister Rabin of Israel has repeatedly stated that Israel cannot be expected to accept all the terms that Egypt demands under pressure from the United States. The United States is obviously worried about the possibility of an oil embargo in the event of another Middle East war. In contrast to claims from Cairo that Israel is responsible for the delay in reaching an agreement, Mr. Rabin has said that miracles cannot be expected within a matter of a few weeks, and that the negotiating process is a long one. The reported feelings of Israeli and American officials alike is that the settlement so desperately needed by both Israel and Egypt may still be a long way off. This is Mark Armstrong, Jerusalem.
And that's the whole point, the settlement that is so desperately needed by all parties concerned, including you and me and people around this world wherever you live. Peace in the Middle East is absolutely critical. It is the source of the energy supply of much of the industrialized world. Ethnically, religiously, it is the heart and the core of some of the problems that divide all of humankind. The very site of the three major religions, the holy places of the three major religions of the Western world are right there. In a very real sense, it's the crossroads of all of the world in the one place where, unlike the orbiting Soyuz and American spacecraft, where Americans can join hands, the Middle East is the one place where the Soviet Union and the United States can come into direct confrontation quicker than any other place on Earth today, including a divided Europe. And do you know that Bible prophecy zeroes in on the Middle East more than any other place on the face of the Earth? That Bible prophecy is actually written from the point of view of the Middle East, looking out from that point to all other parts of the world. In the 11th chapter of Daniel is a prophecy that talks about the end time when there will come a northern power like an avalanche into the Middle East, even including the overthrow and occupation of Egypt. And it does symbolize the very beginning of a nuclear bomb World War III. The only question is when, not whether. And the only way you can know is by getting the overview and keeping in pace with the one publication that gives you the complete scope of what is happening in this world in the light of Bible prophecy. You can have your free copy of the current number of The Plain Truth and these articles, not only about the Middle East, but reactor sales, whether it's a shortcut to nuclear nightmare, the new one on Japan debating its defense posture, and the one on the roots of American success. And all you need to do is to request it by sending your letter to Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. We need that. That's all. There is no cost, but tell us the name of the radio station to which you've been listening, the call letters, and then send your letter to Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales.